and I'll just talk about what I want to talk about.
Right? So as long as everybody agreed, we thought it looked like a good idea. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to have our first evening, as Chris said, begin with an examination of both Adventureland and Frontierland, who were two of the original lands that opened here at the park. And for those of you who maybe know me or have been to other presentations I've done, you might know, because I'm very vocal about it, that one of my very favorite collectible passions is records. And I don't mean file cabinets and things. I mean phonograph records. These are really big CDs, kids, for those of you out there. But the recorded sound, there's such a wealth of Disney music and Disney sound and Disney history all through the records. And so I tend to try and slip in as much about records as I can, kind of championing one of my lost formats here as I can when I do my presentation. So here you see two records. We're going to hear a little bit from records as we go through our adventure through Adventureland and Frontierland tonight. These two particular records are from the 1950s, and they detail the land of adventure where we're going to begin. But some of you might not know that actually there is an official theme song for Adventureland. Who knew that? Anyone? One person? Nope, you did. Very good. Okay, who told you? Ooh, not that one, no. I know the one you mean, but it's not that one. It's not the official song. We'll talk after. But the official song that was written before actually Disney had its own record label. It came out on a little golden record. That's the cover that you see over there on the right side of the screen. Anybody remember little golden records, big kids? They're yellow, they're about about 6.5 inches. Okay, so what we're going to hear now to kick off Adventureland is that little yellow piece of plastic from 1955.
How would you like to take a ride on a river boat?
How would you like to meet a lion face to face?
If you think you'd like to see a monkey swinging from a tree, Adventureland, that's the place.
How would you like to see a baby crocodile?
Maybe you'll run across an alligator too.
If you think you'd like to go where the tiger lilies grow, Adventureland, that's for you. There's a real large jungle there for you to explore. There's a real many village there and so much more. Lots of extraordinary things that look from your geography book.
So if you want to take a trip that you won't forget,
there are such exciting things for you to see.
I'll be back to show you how. There's a boat that's leaving now. Come to Adventureland.
Unexpected people. Some of you may know the Norman Luboff Chorale. They were a choir that recorded very heavily in the 1950s and 60s. Beautiful, beautiful choral work. Also, you may have heard of the song The Way We Were by Barbra Streisand performed and her movie Yentl. Well, Norman Luboff wrote the music to that song we just heard, and Marilyn Keith, who later married Alan Bergman and became Marilyn of Marilyn and Alan Bergman, who won an Oscar for The Way We Were, wrote the lyrics to that song we just heard. So, Oscar-winning music for the Oscars, but all in honor of monkeys and gorillas in Disneyland. So, pretty neat, I say. But Adventureland is a great place to start because really when you look at the times in 1955 when Disneyland opened, and most specifically 1954 when the publicity really started rolling in anticipation of Disneyland's opening, Adventureland was the most hotly anticipated area of the park because it was the home of the Jungle Cruise. Everybody was just nuts over the Jungle Cruise. They couldn't believe that Walt Disney was building a jungle in the middle of Southern California. But of course, who better to do so? So before we start going into a little bit more detail on Adventureland, let me take you back to October 27th of 1954. That's the very first broadcast of Walt Disney's weekly television series. We all grew up watching it with various names. First it was Disneyland, then it was Walt Disney Presents, then it was The Wonderful World of Color, then it was The Wonderful World of Disney, then it was just Disney, then
world. So on and on and on for decades. But that's the same show. It just kept changing its name. But the very first episode, October 27, 1954, was devoted to not only premiering Disneyland the show, but really having Walt have a national stage on which to put forward the concept of Disneyland the place, which would be opening in July of the following year. So here's a little bit of an intro that he did to the concept of what Adventureland would be.
Adventureland, the base of operations for our camera teams in almost every sector of the world. Within Adventureland is the wonder world of nature's own design. Her animal creatures, her fabulous plan of life. Here, too, is a world of unusual people and faraway places.
So Walt intended to use Adventureland not just as a jungle full of fun, but also as a place to really do some good work for nature and conservation, and to have an awareness of the beauty of the natural world around you. And that's pretty altruistic for what people were branding Walt's little amusement park in the Orange Grove, isn't it? He had much bigger plans from the very, very beginning. But the Jungle Cruise was something that Walt was very intrigued into, and it was one of the first things really put into motion as far as Disneyland's construction began, when it really began happening after the ground was cleared. Because the problem with the jungle is you need what? You need jungle, you need plants, yes, and you can't just instantly zap a giant overgrown jungle into being. So landscaper Bill Evans went to work immediately trying to plant things so that we could have some actual growth by the time Disneyland opened in July of 55. But one of my favorite stories, you can see the little aerial view there of the layout on the Jungle River. An Imagineer that was picked to be really the key designer of the Jungle Cruise was given the task of designing a route, and they couldn't really decide where to put it. They said, well, it's all just flat here. There's no topography to speak of. What should we do? And this Imagineer said, well, you know, I have a pretty good visual sense here. Follow me. So he got a stick, literally, a stick. He went out on the site in the dirt and walked the course and dragged the stick behind him. And when he got back, he said, okay, there's your track. And that's exactly the way it happened with that stick track. And that Imagineer was a gentleman named Harper Goff. And I have both Walt and Harper holding a model of the submarine Nautilus from the wonderful Disney film 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Harper was a Hollywood art director. He'd come from Warner Brothers straight to Disney. And one of his earliest assignments at Disney was to design the submarine Nautilus. So he designed that beautiful ship, and he also is the one who dragged the stick in the dirt and designed the Jungle Cruise. But he did so much more, and I wanted to give Harper kind of a little bit of his due, because he also worked extensively in Frontierland. He was all over Disney projects, including and all the way up to Epcot Center. And he also did some freelance work out in Hollywood that you might know, including he was the art director for the original production of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder. You know, the big chocolate room and all those wonderful things? That's all the same line that gave you the Nautilus and the Jungle Cruise. But Harper did have one thing that he didn't get to do. He got really close to it, but he didn't get to do it. He almost got to be a movie star. And I wanted to have a little moment for that. Harper had a little bit role in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and it was cut. This is a still of Harper, and I went back into my little archives and I pulled out my shooting script for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, so I thought I would do a dramatic reading of Harper's role, which never got to be seen. He's in the shipping office here, and if you know the story of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the submarine Nautilus has been confused for a very great sea monster and has thrown all of the shipping and all of the sea traffic out of busy San Francisco Bay just completely for a loop, and no one can get in or get out. So this missionary here is at the ticket window, and he's dealing with the ticket clerk in great frustration. So Harper says, surely you can't strand us in this wicked town. I simply have to be in the Solomons by Christmas. The mission expects me. And then the shipping agent says, I can't help it, Reverend. There's not a man jack will step aboard while this monster's on the loose. And then the missionary, Harper, turns to Professor Aronnax, Paul Lucas, and says, those poor heathens, they won't have a stitch on by the time we get there. So that was to be his dramatic debut. Now, that footage was shot, but it is considered lost. If we ever find it, check your Blu-ray. We'll put it on. But at this point, it's not there. So even though he didn't get to be a film star, Harper did get to star in yet another arena, not just design, but he was also a member of the Firehouse 5+2. This is the great Dixieland jazz band that was founded on the Walt Disney Studio lot. It was primarily a bunch of Disney artists and others who liked to just jam at lunchtime. And Gord Kimmel was their leader, and they got so good they started doing local dances, and then they got to go and make records, and then they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, and all kinds of things. They toured the planet, but yet they still had to go back and do their job at the Disney Studio. The corner picture there that you see in the upper right is the Firehouse Five with Bob Cummings in front of them. He was one of the MCs for Disneyland's opening day, and that's from the live telecast on July 17th of 1955. Harper is the one standing on the running board playing banjo. So instead of just telling you about it, I thought you'd like to see a little bit of the Firehouse Five in action and hear Harper Goth on banjo. So even though it's July and it's a bit warm, let's have a little Jingle Bells from the Firehouse 5+2 and their television debut on One Hour in Wonderland, Walt Disney's very first ever television program. This is well before the series, and that was Christmas Day of 1950. So I'll tell you a few of the artists as they come on. That's animator Frank Thomas on keyboard. Right here in Disneyland, which some of you may have seen and not necessarily noticed, though. Our Window on Main Street program is quite well known. It was Walt's way of giving screen credit to a lot of the artists and other people who helped make Disneyland a reality. Harper also has a window, but it's not on Main Street. You will be able to find Harper Goff's window in Adventureland, right by the Jungle Cruise, which is appropriate since he was the lead designer. But now you know why it says Professor Harper Goff, banjo lessons given. Now, I can't tell you about the oriental tattooing. But if you're in Adventureland with the Jungle Cruise behind you, you're looking at the Adventureland Bazaar, Harper's window is up on the second floor, just to the immediate right of the main entrance of the bazaar. So next time you pass by there, give him a little wave and thank him for all the wonderful Imagineering that he gave us. A wonderful, wonderful time. Now, before we leave the Jungle Cruise, I did want to have one other little tidbit that will come your way. You are all well aware of Walt Disney's very famous attention to detail. You know, he was not above inspecting the most minute details of any figure, any decor piece, any prop, any piece of music. There he is inspecting one of the decorative shields that went onto the gates adorning the Adventureland walkway. Well, one thing you might not know is that as Disneyland neared completion, you know, it was a race to get everything done in time for the announced press opening on July 17th, and Walt had everything at stake, everything. So he was here constantly, and he was looking at everything, trying to help, and doing everything he could, not only from a design and guidance standpoint, but sometimes from a physical aspect. He was over in Adventureland, and they were busily working on Schweitzer Falls, the famous site of the backside of water, you know? And they were doing too well, and Walt asked the foreman, he said, yeah, we're running behind, we're shorthanded. So Walt said, okay, and literally, actually, he rolled up his sleeves, grabbed a trowel, and Walt Disney himself troweled out part of Schweitzer Falls. So turn away from the backside of water next time you go by there and take a peek at that stonework, because some of it is the handiwork of Walt Disney himself, which is pretty neat. Now, the Jungle Cruise was the thing in Adventureland until a very large addition happened in 1962. That large addition was the Swiss Family Treehouse, based on the 1960 film Swiss Family Robinson. The tree actually was grown and opened in 1962, but grown is actually not the right word, because it is, in Latin, a Disney Dendron Semperflorens Grandis, which means large, ever-blooming Disney tree, because we built it. And, of course, when you build a tree, you have complete control over the design. The actual tree in which the real treehouse for the film was built was on the island of Tobago, and I'm happy to say that it's still there, and it still looks great. Doesn't have the treehouse in it anymore, but you can still tell it's that same beautiful tree with that unique configuration. But we had to build our tree from scratch, of course, so Walt wanted to get a little bit more design, so we can control the design a bit more since we were in charge of it. So, something you might not know, that the Swiss Family Tree really does have its roots in Anaheim here, more so than just as a structure. Walt really liked the roots of a huge Morton Bay fig tree that's here in Anaheim. It's on West Street in Anaheim's Founders Park. It was planted in the 1800s by an Anaheim botanist, and it has the most gorgeous, huge root system, very decorative and beautiful. So Walt sent the Imagineers over to see that tree and said, make the tree have those roots. And it does. So next time you're driving around Anaheim on West Street, look for Founders Park and go see the beautiful Morton Bay fig, and you can see where the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse for Disneyland, which of course is now under the care of its new tenant, Tarzan, you can see where those roots came from and see how Walt took inspiration from anything and everything that ran across his path that he thought might be useful. But after the Tiki Room opened in 1962, there wasn't too much time until the next big thing happened in Adventureland, and that happened just about 50 years ago. In fact, on June 23rd of 1963, that was the grand opening of Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. Now, the two renderings I have here, the one at the top by John Hench and the one at the bottom by Sam McKim, two illustrious, legendary Disney Imagineers, show the Tiki Room as it was first developed, and that's as a restaurant. And Walt thought it would be great to have a Polynesian restaurant because backyard luau's and tiki torches and all this stuff was all the rage in the early 60s. And we thought, well, then we can have this restaurant, and then we'll have these birds up top, and with this new system I'm working on, we'll have these mechanical birds, and they'll do a number every once in a while, and it'll be great. And Walt was so intrigued and enthused by this that he kept adding to the show and adding to the show. And every time he added something to the show, two or three tables had to get moved out because they just didn't have room for it. So pretty soon, it was this really small capacity restaurant with a tremendous show. And they decided, perhaps the food idea needs to go away. So it did go away, and the result, of course, was the Enchanted Tiki Room as we know it. Of course, it was the biggest undertaking for a single attraction that the Imagineers had ever done. And it was great fun for the female Imagineers because they got to do all kinds of really beautiful work on feathering and beading and jewels and flowers. And I thought I'd salute our lady Imagineers here by showing you three Tiki Room era photos of them. The lady in the brown there is Harriet Burns, who some of you may remember. She was the very first female Imagineer at Walt Disney Imagineering when it was first called WED Enterprises. The lady at the center, that's Baroness Glendra von Kessel, and her design aesthetic was extremely frilly and detailed. She especially worked on the birds of the Birdmobile with all of their jeweled eye makeup and extreme cockatiel plumage. She was great at that. And the lady among the flowers is Leota Toombs, who you will know as the face behind Madame Leota in the Haunted Mansion in the Crystal Ball. And in real life, she was married to Disney animator Harvey Toombs, and their daughter is today Kim Irvine, who's one of the chief Imagineers entrusted with keeping Disneyland beautiful. So the family dynasty continues there. But no matter how beautiful the Tiki Room was, it still had a problem. They mocked it up without the restaurant tables on one of the sound stages at the Disney studio, and they had it doing its paces. It would do like Hawaiian war chant and a couple luau-type numbers, and that was it, but it didn't really have an identity. And so one day, Walt called his staff songwriters in, and this would be Richard M. and Robert B. Sherman. Walt had many songwriters work at the Disney studio through the years, but only the Shermans were put on as full-time staff. And so he brought them in there and ran this thing for them, and they said, that was great, but what is it? And Walt literally turned to them and said, that's the point. You're going to write a song that says what this is. And I'm like, okay. So they ran back and went to work, and the resulting song was the Tiki 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 Room song. And with that, the attraction opened on June 23rd of 1963, and Walt was enormously proud. He was having a great time with this and just so excited because it was the first true application of his new audio animatronics technology. You know, Walt first started out as a filmmaker, as an animator and a cartoonist, and he wanted to find ways to bring the inanimate to life. He did that through drawings and bringing personality and character and liveliness to a piece of paper in animation was something that really he found compelling. Later on, he forayed into stop motion animation, had some of his artists do some things where you had actual puppets and sculptures that would move frame by frame. But dimensional animation on a much more large, comprehensive scale became a goal of his as technology began to really improve in the late 50s. And so with the advent of computers and robotics and audio animatronics being something that had its basis both in mechanics and in audio tape impulses, he really pulled everything together, and the Enchanted Tiki Room was the beginning of everything that we now know. Think about the Haunted Mansion and Pirates of the Caribbean, and It's a Small World, and all the pavilions for the New York World's Fair. None of that could have happened without the Enchanted Tiki Room. So Walt was thrilled with this new plateau in animation. So let's take a little clip at the Tiki Room's earliest days as represented on the Disneyland 10th Anniversary television episode of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color from 1965.
Aloha! It is showtime now in Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room.
Julie, I think you know our fine feathered friend here, Jose, the host of the Enchanted Tiki Room at Disneyland.
Yes, I've seen him many times here.
Jose, Julie's been selected to represent Disneyland as Miss Tencennial. Do you approve?
Thank you, Jose.
What is this, Senorita?
You know, the same scientific equipment that guides rockets to the moon is used to make Jose and his little friends in the Tiki Room sing, talk, move, and practically think for themselves. I guess you could call him a creature of the space age. But why don't we let Jose speak for himself down at Disneyland and show the folks what goes on behind the scenes.
What is this, senor and senoritas? How do you do down there? Ah, aloha. time now in Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. Hurry, hurry to Tiki Room. Tiki's make drum go boom. Magic is happening. All the birds and flowers sing. Better come see this thing. Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. Come to the Tiki Room. Hurry to the Tiki Room. Now, friends, before we see the show, I take you behind the scene for a few moments. The whole show runs from this room. That fellow is Troubleshooter. He is the electric engineer, also a veterinarian for all the Tiki Room actors. Maybe we'd like to see how everything works, okay? The water power here goes through the pipes and runs the magic fountain. This is muscle assisting all kinds of relays on this panel. They make the cockatoo head turn left and right, make the flower to open and the tiki gods sing. And here is special thing to make coffee. The buzzer. Uh-oh, the show is going to start. Come along, amigos. You gotta find a good seat.
Jose, wake up. It's showtime.
Oh, what is this, senorita? My siestas are getting shorter and shorter. Oh, look at all the people. And welcome to Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room. And now our national anthem.
It's the streetlights and babies sing. Tweet, 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 tweet. It's the streetlights and babies sing. Sweet, 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 sweet. It's the water that Nathan gives. He just holds a treat. Take your time, comes in, bless you, all of your ways. Sweet, 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 sweet.
Great looking, all those wonderful 1965 folks. Well, again, Walt was so proud of the Tiki Room, and he had fun with it. Something else he had fun with, I wanted to mention, this picture of Walt and Jose. You can see also on his desk is another bird. Does anyone recognize that other bird? Mary Poppins, that's right. It's the robin that Julie Andrews does the duet with in Spoonful of Sugar. And he loved that thing. And one funny story, this is absolutely true. Sometimes when he'd have somebody coming to his office for a meeting, and he was like, oh, okay. He didn't really want to be at the meeting, or he thought it was going to go too long. He would put the bird on. And it had a finger harness, as Julie Andrews used, and he'd have the little joystick down here. And so he'd have the bird on when the guy, whoever's in the meeting, would come in, oh, hello, and the bird nod at him. And, you know, how are you? Oh, and this is my little friend. Okay, now what was it you wanted to see me about? And, you know, the bird's looking at him. Yeah, you think so? Yeah. So the person who he was having the meeting with was so flummoxed by this that that meeting ended a lot sooner. And Walt was able to go do his thing like he wanted to. So, you know, he enjoyed his toys, which is a marvelous thing. One other word about Jose the Parrot. Many of you know him very well, but you might not know that his voice is actually one of Disneyland's most famous real-life characters, the great comedian Wally Bogue. And we will be seeing more of Wally Bogue as we journey to our next realm of Disneyland, which is Frontierland. And again, you'll see two covers of two records. And knowing me, does that mean that you might be in for another theme song?
Yes.
Yes, you are. Another Lubov key antique composition there from that little plastic record, Frontierland, even though the Jungle Cruise was a very hotly anticipated attraction, Frontierland itself was not any slouch because, of course, it was the home of cowboys. And if you were around in the 1950s, you know that the primetime schedule on most every network was either a doctor show or a Western at any given time of the evening. Westerns were huge. And when Walt Disney first started broadcasting on that very first episode of Disneyland in October of 1954, he introduced Frontierland by also introducing a star which he thought would do very well in a new Western series he was going to launch as part of his Disneyland anthology show. But little did he dream just how well that star would do. Let me show you Walt's introduction to Frontierland from October 27th of 1954 and somebody's television debut.
Behind the gates of Frontierland is the inspirational America of the past century. Here is the treasure of our native folklore, the songs, tales, and legends of the big men who built the land. Some of them were completely legendary, like Paul Bunyan the Woodchopper with his blue ox Babe. Then again, we find that true stories about real people can be fabulous too. Now in our TV series from Frontierland, we're going to tell about these real people who became legend. Like Davy Crockett, the first coonskin congressman. Now Davy's life was so fantastic, it was hard to tell where fact left off and fancy began. Now here's Norman Foster, director of the unit, who's going to shoot the story of Davy Crockett on Davy's own home grounds, the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee.
Well, tomorrow we push off for the Davy Crockett country. When we were back there looking for locations, I noticed a funny thing. People back there still talk about Davy. They sing songs and they tell stories that have been handed down from generation to generation. In the hearts of these people, old Davy Crockett is still very much alive. Now we're about to shoot a little test here, and it's just as good a way as any way to meet the young man who's going to play Davy. His name is Fess Parker. He'll tell you a little about it in a song. Ready, Fess? Roll. Action.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, greatest state in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so he knew every tree. Killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Fought single-handed through the Indian War, till the Creeks was whipped and the peace was in store. While he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, the man who don't know fear.
He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up a government laws as well. He took over Washington, so I hear tell, and patched up a crack in the Liberty Bell.
Davy, Davy Crockett, seeing his duty clear. He heard of Houston and Austin and so
to the Texas plain he just had to go.
Their freedom was a fighting another foe,
and they needed him at the Alamo. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Debut of the Davy Crockett song as well, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, and little did anyone know that thing would go gold in like 2 weeks. And when the first Davy Crockett episode aired, the ratings were through the roof, and every kid in the country needed to have a coonskin cap like Davy Crockett. So Frontierland became a hotbed of excitement because Davy Crockett, in the person of Fess Parker, and Buddy Ebsen as Georgie Russell, not only were here on Disneyland's opening day as part of the entertainment and festivities on the live telecast, but they also made personal appearances here, as later on did Western hero Zorro. So can you imagine being a little kid of the 50s and being able to come and meet Davy Crockett or come and meet Zorro? It was a huge, huge deal. So Frontierland was a very happening place. I wanted to refer to another of the opening day attractions here at Frontierland, and that was the Mark Twain Riverboat. You can see the Disneyland band having a nice concert on there, and you can see it behind Fess Parker in a publicity still. He's having a little romp in his spare time here at the park. But you'll also notice, though,
that the certificate is there, the pilot certificate, and that is something that has been a very treasured commodity through the years for people who make their way up to the wheelhouse. And it's signed by Walt Disney, Commodore of the Disneyland Navy. I guess, again, when your name's on the sign, you can be the Commodore or whatever you want, which is marvelous. Now, the steamboat on its original route around the rivers of America would pass on a constant basis something which was no longer here at Disneyland, and that was our Disneyland Indian Village. It was a beautiful area with teepees and a ceremonial circle, and Native American groups from all over the country would come and present pageants and do dances and craft demonstrations and perpetuate their crafts and folklore. It was a really lovely place. And we sometimes use it for photo shoots. You'll notice in the center there is former Mouseketeer Annette Funicello in the earliest part of her pop singing days, and they did a photo shoot there for one of her 45 RPM records. Also, the picture on the far right shows another Disney star recreating on one of his free days when he wasn't filming. That's John Davidson and his brother. When John Davidson was taking a day off at Disneyland filming The Happiest Millionaire in 1966, which was a live-action movie musical and the last one produced personally by Walt Disney. And for those of you who are also fans of Walt Disney World and get down there infrequently, when the Indian Village left Disneyland to make way for Bear Country in the early 70s, those same totem poles that you see in those pictures were actually shipped down to Florida. And for many years, they stood in the green area welcoming guests who arrived at Walt Disney World's Fort Wilderness campgrounds. So if you ever took your picture by the totem poles there in the Fort Wilderness campground in Florida, it's those exact same Disneyland poles that you see right there. And of course, we can't talk about Frontierland without Tom Sawyer Island. The island actually opened a year later than Disneyland proper. They didn't have time to make all of the improvements. Walt himself guided all of the adventures and little discovery locations on the island because basically he went home one night after seeing what the Imagineers had sketched out, drew his own in grease pencil, brought it in, and said, here, make this. And they did, because he thought it would be fun. And the souvenir map that was handed out for many years at the island was drawn by Disneyland's chief cartographer, Imagineer Sam McKim. He did the big souvenir maps as well, the ones that never folded up quite right. And another interesting thing about Tom Sawyer Island is when it did open, there was a contest in the hometown of Mark Twain, Hannibal, Missouri, to pick a boy and a girl to come from Hannibal to play Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher here at Disneyland for the opening ceremonies for the island. So there's a postcard of Hannibal's own Tom and Becky there with them and the picket fence there by Aunt Polly's house. That was issued by the city of Hannibal, Missouri. They were so proud. And then there's a picture of the pair with Walt on the island raft. We had many other Tom Sawyers that played the role here at Disneyland, and one of them, Tom Nobby, went on to become a Disney legend because he stayed with the company for many, many decades and was one of the key opening crew of Walt Disney World. So from Tom Sawyer and the River to opening Walt Disney World, you never know where your Disney connections can take you. For a long time, most of the real estate in Frontierland was devoted to nature's wonderland and the mine train. Interweaving with the mine train track, you had the Conestoga wagons and the stagecoaches for a while, also the pack mules. Many of you remember riding the little burros and things. But Nature's Wonderland was a huge parcel of real estate. In it, you saw creatures that were animated by very simple cam and lever pulley systems, and they were mostly depicting scenes from the Disney Nature True Life Adventure films like Bear Country, Beaver Valley, The Olympic Elk, The Vanishing Prairie, The Living Desert, on and on and on. Those films were hugely celebrated and won many, many Oscars, and it was a very big deal to give them a dimensional reality here at Disneyland. And so when that opened up, it was a very big deal. The color piece that you see there was a special insert to the souvenir guidebooks that were sold in 1960, and that long piece that looks so beautifully like a vintage railroad poster of the 1800s, that was a handout at the main entrance so that you would be aware that that was going on in Frontierland when you arrived at Disneyland. Now, because there was so much space in Nature's Wonderland, a lot went on there. For example, you had all the geysers and the bubbling mud pots, and you had the Rainbow Caverns, which a lot of people remember fondly. There was a rock shop in Frontierland where they had a black light phosphorescent rock display, and you could buy phosphorescent rocks and black lights there too. That was inspired by Rainbow Caverns, where you had kind of a surreal, otherworldly collection of stalactites, stalagmites, glowing water, iridescent pools, all kinds of things that glowed in the dark and looked very, very neat. The music in Rainbow Caverns was this kind of ethereal choir of voices seeming to come forth from the depths of the caves. And it was the first use in a Disney film or attraction of a theremin. Does anyone know what a theremin is? Okay, some people do, good. Well, for those of you who don't, a theremin, it's a science fiction type of instrument. It's made by altering electric waves. And somebody didn't know what this was earlier, and so I did my theremin impression for them. So just so you know, this is what a theremin sounds like. It's kind of otherworldly ooing. It goes. Movies. Let me try one more time, too. That's the tone I wanted. Okay. But if you listen to science fiction movies, usually when the space monster is approaching or the science fiction flying saucer is landing, the theremin is the instrument you hear. So if you're a fan of interesting film music, that is Disney's first theremin use, and that's a big deal. Now, the other pictures that you see there are kind of fun. The record album cover on the lower left is a group of musicians. They're called the Yachtsmen, and their LP was called High and Dry with the Yachtsmen. They used to play at the Tomorrowland Yacht Bar, and they had kind of a nautical theme to their clothes, as you can see. And one day, and I don't think you're supposed to do this, they were returning from a break or something by kind of taking a shortcut through the living desert. And somebody from the marketing team saw them and said, "Boy, look at these guys in their sailor outfits in the desert. They look kind of high and dry." And so that's where the idea for the record album cover came from. So there's High and Dry with the Yachtsmen in the living desert from Nature's Wonderland. Then up at the top, that's actually a still from a Universal Pictures film. It's called 40 Pounds of Trouble, and it starred Tony Curtis and Suzanne Plachette, and it has a major sequence that was filmed right here at Disneyland, the first film, actually, outside of Disney, to feature footage from Disneyland. Tom Hanks' That Thing You Do was the second, if you remember that. And there's one coming up in the fall, which I shall not say. But, you'll see it, don't worry. But the thing about 40 Pounds of Trouble is they had a lot of time at Disneyland. Tony Curtis is trying to outrun a policeman with this little girl who's wearing the mouse ears there. And so they park in the parking lot here at Disneyland, which is, of course, now the home of our Disney California Adventure Park. But they run through the parking lot, and they jump on the monorail. And then they jump on the monorail, run real fast through the monorail, get off the monorail on Main Street. How does that happen? That's the magic of movies. So Tony Curtis gets off the monorail onto Main Street and runs, and soon finds himself inside Nature's Wonderland, where there's an extensive sequence, kind of a Keystone Cops kind of a chase type thing, all through the living desert and all of the various animal tableaus in Nature's Wonderland. So if you ever get a chance to see that, it's in CinemaScope, so adjust your television's aspect ratio correctly, and you can see the broad, beautiful panoramic views of Disneyland's Nature's Wonderland in color from the early 1960s. It's a really great, great watch. Now we come to perhaps the crown jewel of early Disneyland, and that is the Golden Horseshoe Cafe, home of Slookwood Sue and the Golden Horseshoe Review, which to this day still has the Guinness Book of World Records title for the longest continuously running stage show. It ran from 1955, Disneyland's opening, all the way up until 1986. So not too shabby a run. You can see there's a concept piece for the exterior, as well as a Sam McKim rendering of the interior of the saloon. Actually, one of the designers for the horseshoe, though, was not just Sam, but also Harper Goff, whom we spent some time with earlier. He had just finished work before coming to Disney on a picture for Doris Day at Warner Brothers called Calamity Jane. And in Calamity Jane, there's a saloon called the Silver Slipper. So when it came time, like, well, we're doing Disneyland now, and we need a saloon, he basically kind of had the blueprints in his trunk. I mean, it was that fresh. He's like, oh, okay, I have a saloon. So in it came. And if you look at the film Calamity Jane and look inside our beautiful Golden Horseshoe Saloon Theater, you will see a remarkable resemblance. But the Golden Horseshoe Review itself was a revolution. It was a live stage show. It was musical. It was comedy. It was vaudeville. It was contemporary. And it was semi-scripted, so you never knew what was going to happen. And the cast was led by three Disney legends, Wally Bogue, who as his alter ego, the traveling salesman, and Pecos Bill constantly stole the show and spit a lot of teeth out into the audience. Those of you who remember know what I mean. And Betty Taylor at center, who was Slewfoot Sue from 1956 onward. And Fulton Burley. And I don't have a horseshoe picture of him here because I want to note that Fulton did a lot more than just be at the horseshoe. You know that Wally was the voice of Jose, and he also wrote quite a bit of comedic material for other Disney endeavors. You can also see Wally in The Absent-Minded Professor and Son of Flubber, if you watch for him. He has featured little bit roles. But Fulton Burley, who was a friend of Wally's when they were both under contract at the MGM studios, he was a full-out Irish tenor, and he became kind of Disneyland's de facto all-purpose master of ceremonies. He crisscrossed the world touring on behalf of Buena Vista Pictures Distribution, taking the new and the reissued animated features and stage shows to various cities and announcing their arrival with a great deal of showmanship. And he was a perfect person to do this, but kind of Disneyland's unofficial ambassador, even though we had our ambassador program from 1965 on. But three marvelous, marvelous performers. And there were a lot of other guest stars who appeared occasionally at the Golden Horseshoe. Julie Andrews stopped in one day while she was filming Mary Poppins in 1963. Wally Bogue had been a vaudevillian performer in London going back to the 1950s. And as a little girl soprano, Julie Andrews had been a featured performer and appeared with Wally at the Starlit Roof at the London Palladium. So they had a really marvelous reunion, and here you see them singing By the Light of the Silvery Moon on the Golden Horseshoe stage. The other photo shows Wally and the original Golden Horseshoe tenor, who was there just for a few years until the early 60s. His name was Donald Novus. And Don Novus was a favorite singer of Walt's. You can hear him going back to 1942. He's the singer singing Love is a Song That Never Ends under the opening credits of Bambi, as well as in Lady and the Tramp, the Christmas scene that begins that story. You have a little piece on earth, very lovely Christmas hymn. That's the voice of Donald Novus. And just to give you one more piece of trivia, Donald's sister, Julietta Novus, she's the lead soloist in 1940's original recording of Ave Maria for Fantasia. So a very talented family. But you can see Wally and Don are there by the Rivers of America with three other talented singers, Patty Maxine and Laverne, the Andrews sisters. And the Andrews sisters had recorded a couple pieces for Disney, Little Toot and Johnny Fedora and Alice Blue Bonnet in the 1940s, but they were here appearing on a radio show. Disneyland was host to many radio broadcasts, as well as, for a while, its own series called Meet Me at Disneyland, which aired on Channel 11, local television for the Los Angeles area, and often featured guest stars like the Andrews sisters. So Frontierland was a very busy place, and the horseshoe seemed to be the hub of it. So speaking of the horseshoe, let's take a very special little trip back in time to 1962, when the Golden Horseshoe Review celebrated a major milestone, and Walt Disney celebrated that on an episode of The Wonderful World of Color on NBC. So get on your six-shooters and your 10-gallon hats, and we're about to meet our host.
Attention, please. Will Walt Disney's special guests please go to the Golden Horseshoe in Frontierland? Thank you. Howdy, folks. Glad you all can be with us for the 10,000th performance of the Golden Horseshoe Review here in Frontierland in Disneyland. Now, for this special occasion, we call it the Augmented Golden Horseshoe Review. And that's because, in addition to our usual stars, Wally Bogue and Betty Taylor, we have some special guest stars. Now, we got a real root-to-shootin' show. I've got my table reserved for you, so fly over that way and do those little bitty old doughs and tell them who I'll smash it. Sorry, folks. There are no seats left. We're full out.
It's all right, Marshal. We're holding the off stage for them.
Sorry.
Please follow me. Make yourself comfortable, and we hope you enjoy our show.
Oh, I think. think I know what you mean.
Good.
Okay, Maestro, get it. Mr. Piano Man, please tickle those ivory keys. No one can noodle the way that you doodle those rippy-ticky melodies. Mr. Piano Man, you do what nobody can do. Your tremolos are gonna drive me to ruin. Your left don't know exactly what your right hand is doing. Oh, Mr. Piano Man,
quite famous for having played the role of Bernardo, who was Zorro's pretend deaf-mute henchman, or like, he was a good guy, so he's not a henchman, but assistant, I guess we'll say, on Zorro, and also a star of Walt Disney's Technicolor musical Babes in Toyland, as was, of course, the special guest star, and I know you recognize the beautiful Annette Funicello. This was a role that she played just kind of at the last minute, actually. She filmed Babes in Toyland at Disney and was just on the brink of leaving behind kind of Disney fairy tale princesshood to become Queen of the Beach, still under contract to Walt before American International Pictures. And Henry Calvin, who had played Sergeant Garcia on Zorro and had also been Good Zorro in Babes in Toyland, fell ill, and he was going to be doing some routines with Gene Sheldon doing the horseshoe. So before they could really, you know, scrap production, they were kind of midway, and they contacted Annette and said, would you be able to come and be in this production? She said, absolutely. So the Sherman Brothers wrote Mr. Piano Man just for her, and they prepared that special special number, and that was one of Annette's most glamorous appearances under the Disney banner. And there's the sleeve of the single of Mr. Piano Man. So a wonderful Disneyland moment. Now, I hate to say it, but that brings us to our tour's end of Frontierland. But I do want to say a little goodbye. There's so many ways to end a Disneyland celebration. It's always best to end, you know, with Walt, of course. And Walt did make himself present. Unlike a lot of people who headed large companies, they were, you know, locals and offices, Walt was very present. He was hosting his TV show. He wrote introductions for guidebooks. He went out into the park to see people, ask them if they were enjoying themselves. Sometimes he tried to disguise himself and ride things so that he could say, well, that ride ran slow or that ride ran fast. And, you know, he got recognized a whole lot after the television show was on, of course. But Walt was omnipresent and still is omnipresent in Disneyland, which is a very special thing. And one reason why I'm particularly glad to say that Disneyland is my hometown, because it's Walt's theme park, and it's the only, you can only have one first, and this is the first, and I think to my thinking it's the crown jewel because it is Walt's park. So best way I thought of to end is not just by pulling another film clip that had Walt in it, because how can you beat him in his cowboy gear there? I thought, being as it's my show, I would end with another record. Okay, thank you. Well, this is a record that's actually very special. It is the official theme song of Disneyland. Did you know it had one? No, it really does. And this has been heard very fleetingly as in recent years, because we did bring out an instrumental recording as part of the music for the 1964 New York World's Fair pavilions. But for those of you who don't know, Disneyland itself has this theme song, and it was written to be heard whenever Walt would talk about not Disneyland the show, since the TV show had its same name for the first several years, but Disneyland the place. So if you listen, if you have any of the DVDs, like the Walt Disney Treasures, and you see Walt talking about Disneyland, in fact, this melody even played under one of the clips that we showed earlier tonight. This little melody is called Disneyland, and it's about Disneyland the place. The music was by Disney music director George Bruns, who also wrote The Ballad of Davy Crockett. And the lyrics are by Larry Morey, whose Disney association goes all the way back to being the lyricist for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937. So that's a long association. Thing is, it was only used instrumentally through all its years on the Disney television program. Anybody can only find one recording that actually has the lyrics, and it's one of those little plastic yellow records. So that withstanding, you know, think about this being not just a recording, but a recording meant for little children to play and enjoy over and over too. Because after all, isn't Disneyland aimed toward the child in a human of any age, whether you're a chronological child or at that spot in you which retains the sweetness and joy of your childhood? So listen to that as you hear the Disneyland song, and we've cut some picture to it that will be hopefully appropriate.
Disneyland, shining star in Disneyland. If your heart is a youthful guide, you can see there you'll find
Disneyland a magical place, but for being interested in this wonderful golden period of the past on which all of our fun of today is so very firmly built. I hope that you'll be able to be with us next Tuesday, where we'll be having a presentation talking about Fantasyland and Tomorrowland. And then Tuesday. Next Tuesday. And then the Tuesday after that will be Main Street USA. So please think about joining us for those. Also, as you leave the Opera House tonight, please be sure and see one of us out in the hallway because we have a little gift for you. I mentioned that the Enchanted Tiki Room just celebrated its 50th anniversary on June 23rd, and so we have some replicas of actual 1963 handouts from the Tiki Room.
Wicked.
Yeah.